Well, I've thought of somewhere secure that he could stay, if not in Buckingham Palace. He could stay in Belmarsh Prison, like the war criminal that he is, and where already there are incarcerated the victims of the so-called war on terror, which is really a war of terror, and which is busily shredding our ancient liberties and freedoms on both sides of the Atlantic. One file of Botox. As somebody said, you'd find more in Joan Collins's makeup bag. And it wouldn't be 12 years old either. No, Lindsay's right. This really is mental health territory. I mean, come back, Alistair Campbell. Whoever advised Tony Blair, when half the country thinks he's a lying, scheming conspirer, when more than half the country thinks he's George Bush's poodle, when George Bush is the least popular man on the planet, when more than half the people think Tony Blair should resign, when the Labour Party's in a state, despite the Nuremberg rally at Bournemouth, of incipient rebellion against his leadership, whoever advised him, I've got an idea, Tony. With one bound, we can be free of all this. I could put you back at the top of the pops. Why don't you invite George W. Bush to come and visit London for 3 days? We could have him inspecting the troops. We can have him living with the Queen in Buckingham Palace. We could give that Stop the War crowd the opportunity of making a huge festival of opposition to British and American imperialism. We could get millions back onto the streets of Britain saying, Bush, go home. You really have to wonder if Tony Blair hasn't secretly joined us. I mean, you're the leader, you've got the membership files. I wouldn't be surprised if when the 30-year rule is lifted, that we discover that Blair was one of us all along. I felt that way when some of the older friends will remember when Harold Wilson, who we always thought was a right-wing sellout, when he was accused very late in life of actually having been a Soviet agent all along. I feel a bit like that about Tony Blair. I cannot believe that, like manna from heaven, they have given us this opportunity. And Lindsay outlined some of the things that we have planned. I must say, I didn't realize we were going to build a statue of George Bush and then pull it down. That is just the most wonderful news I've heard. I was much more modest. As a Roman Catholic myself, I've always felt that Guy Fawkes got a bit of a raw deal. He has been burning on the top of bonfires for hundreds of years. And after all, he wasn't the last man to enter Parliament with bad intentions. And I just felt that historically we should give Guy Fawkes a rest now and find a couple of more deserving guys to put on top of the bonfires on the 5th of November. But we've been given a heaven-sent opportunity to really set this country alight with opposition, not just to Bush in Iraq, not just even to Bush in Afghanistan, to Bush's role in the massacre which is continuing today and this evening in the Rafah camp in Gaza, in Palestine, but Bush's entire approach to the world, his wrecking of the International Criminal Court, his effective destruction of the environmental protocols of Kyoto, his blocking of anti-proliferation measures of small arms and chemical weapons. No, I'm not making that up. The United States government actually wrecked the International Convention to Control the Proliferation of Chemical Weapons. Brutish way in which Bush has projected American power rampaging around the world like a giant with the mind of a child, which is effectively what his presidency has been doing. If we can build a coalition of all the people who are concerned about all of these things, then we really can set Britain alight with opposition. And it will be very important in our own country but it will be very important in the United States itself. Because the real reason that Bush is coming here is not to help out Tony Blair. Even Tony Blair's not that stupid that he thinks Bush being here for 3 days is going to make his life easier. The real reason that Bush is here is because he's running for president in 12 months' time and he's already in trouble. And you know, virtually the only card that he has to play to the mounting dissatisfaction about the war in the United States, its cost in blood and treasure, is that Tony Blair was in on it too. That the British are still shoulder to shoulder, lips to posterior, four square beside us. It's really come to something that the most right-wing American president ever, who's being pursued throughout the United States by the seven dwarves of the American Democratic Party vying for the right to stand against him, who are hammering him daily on the war, that his only protection is the leader of the British Labour Party. It really has come to something that a right-wing president comes to a Labour-governed Britain in order to win votes and defeat the Democratic Party challenge to him in the presidential election. That's the reason why Bush is coming. And we can therefore play a potentially important, maybe more than important role in sending the message to the American people. This is why our propaganda and our actions in all respects have to take account of the fact that we bear no ill will ever to the people of the United States. But we hate their president and we hate the role that their country is now playing in international affairs. And if we do that in sufficient numbers, we may decisively affect the outcome of the US presidential election next year. Because if the American people finally realize that even the British, who have been welded to our hip throughout all this period, are in their millions saying Bush has got to go, then it might play a very important role in the outcome of the election. And we have taken great care, the speakers that we've invited and the propaganda that we have leveled. This is an anti-Bush demonstration, it's not an anti-American demonstration, and we must keep that very much in the front of our minds. We don't want people burning the American flag, for example. We're not against America, and we're not against Americans. It's George Bush we want on the bonfire with Tony Blair, not the American people themselves. Now, the last time I spoke in this room was just a couple of days before the war. I see many of my friends here this evening who were there. I think I can safely say, if it doesn't sound conceited, that every single thing I predicted in that speech in this room that day has come to pass. Every single thing that I said, I told them in Parliament, out of years of experience, you will open the gates of hell if you invade Iraq. When you have toppled the regime and occupied Baghdad, as Mr. Churchill might have put it, it will not be the beginning of the end, merely the end of the beginning. I told them that you will face mass resistance from the Iraqi people, who are not less than the Palestinian people, who face their occupation day and daily and are ready to sacrifice their lives against foreign occupation. They are not less than the resistance fighters of Greece, of Yugoslavia, of France, of Italy. They are not less than we would have been if the Nazis had occupied our country, where every person in this room would have, to the best of their ability, struck against the violent, illegal, foreign military occupation of their country. Over and over I warned them that this fantasy, this racist fantasy, that alone of all the people in the world, the Iraqis were just waiting for hundreds of thousands of foreign soldiers to fall upon them, like wolves. Yes, Mr. Blair, like wolves. The idea that they would greet such wolves with flowers and rice, that the women would be tearing off their non-existent burqas and French kissing the GIs as they came rampaging through their towns. The idea that the Iraqis would welcome foreign soldiers kicking down their doors invading the privacy of their women, turning over their houses, dragging out their sons, forcing them face down into the dust, tying their hands behind their backs, putting hoods over their heads, taking them off to prison camps. It was a racist fantasy that the Iraqi people would ever tolerate such a thing lying down. And who can now dispute it? Instead of being welcomed, instead of being hit with flowers and rice, the Iraqi resistance, north, south, east and west, is striking at the occupation forces. And they are, as Lindsay said, now frequently coming within a hair's breadth of really major disasters. Of course, it's a major disaster for the one, two or three American soldiers who are being killed every day, and for their families and their communities, and the thousands, literally thousands, who are being wounded. 6,000 American soldiers have been evacuated out of Iraq since the beginning of the war. Hundreds have been killed. The rate of deaths is increasing, now to an average of one per day. But they're coming close to Lebanon-style major disasters, like the one in the Baghdad hotel that Lindsay referred to, which came very close to dealing an absolutely decisive blow at the most important centers of power. In our own ranks, yesterday in the south of Iraq, four British soldiers in two separate incidents were blown up by bombs. None of them was killed. All four of them might easily have been killed. And instead of four, it might have been 14. And we have 11,000 British men, predominantly poor, young British men, conscripted by unemployment, by lack of opportunity, into the armed forces and sent to the south of Iraq to occupy somebody else's country. For what? For the enrichment of George Bush's corporate friends and what they hoped would be for the re-election of George W. Bush, although it's not working out that way on either of those counts at the minute. Those 11,000 British soldiers are surrounded by millions of Shiite Muslims who are one fatwa away from a general uprising in the south of Iraq, which, if it happens, will lead to the massacre, and I mean massacre, of huge numbers of young British servicemen. And if that happens, the blood will be on Tony Blair's hands and nobody else's. Because we have to be clear about one thing. The Iraqis have every right to resist the foreign occupation of their country. And it's out of concern for our own young men that we say the British armed forces must be withdrawn from Iraq without delay. And that's one of the demands that we as a coalition are making and will be making in the activities of the 19th, 20th and 21st. And it's one of the reasons why this coalition is still on the march. The situation in the world has become fantastically more dangerous, as I predicted in this room on that occasion just before the war. Far from the war making the world a safer place, I mean, if you think about it, you didn't actually need a Cambridge education to work out that hundreds of thousands of Western soldiers invading an Arab Muslim country and occupying it would be likely to make Islamic fundamentalist terrorism a bigger rather than a smaller problem. You didn't have to be a genius to work out that the effect around the world would be to make it a more dangerous place. And if you look on the Foreign Office's website this evening, you will see a list of countries as long as your arm where your own government is telling you it's not safe for you as British people to travel to. I came today from the House of Commons, first day back at school. It's swarming with armed security personnel. The corridors, the tea rooms, outside, inside, men with machine guns guarding the British Parliament. So in terror are they from the forces which they have themselves conjured forth. My last point is this, because I'm running out of time. This issue of Iraq and Afghanistan cannot be separated from the danger of further war. You know, people say to me, The Americans are in such trouble in Iraq. How could they possibly invade Iran? How could they possibly invade Syria, Cuba, North Korea? In fact, the opposite is true, as anyone who knows history can see. The deeper they got into trouble in Vietnam, the more they escalated and spread the war. The bombing isn't working, do more bombing. 1 million American soldiers is not succeeding, make it 2 million. Pulverizing Vietnam isn't working, attack Cambodia, attack Laos. At every stage, Johnson and Nixon, when they got into difficulties in Vietnam, escalated and spread the war as a diversion, as well as what they saw as a military imperative. And they're softening you up for the next attacks. Bush, in the last 48 hours, has launched a huge propaganda offensive against Cuba, threatening the American people with severe punishments if they travel to Cuba, threatening Canada and Mexico, their partners in the NAFTA, about the levels of their investment and trade with Cuba, elevating the Cuban government to the axis of evil. Syria has already been attacked by America's proxy, Sharon's Israel. And Israel today is threatening still more attacks. Indeed, Sharon said today the attack on Syria had been long overdue, and warned the Syrian regime that the rhetoric coming out of Damascus might very well invite further and more dramatic attacks from his forces. And Iran, which is their number one target, any day now, remember you heard it here, any day now, the Israeli Air Force will bomb Iran's nuclear industry and plant. Any day, you will wake up and hear on the Today program that the Israeli Air Force has attacked Iran. With all the terrifying dangers of escalation of the conflict and the spreading of the conflict that represents. Even miraculously, they shelved the Pope for the Nobel Prize last week and gave it to an Iranian opposition figure to keep up the propaganda offensive against the regime in Tehran. The world is a fantastically dangerous place, and we have a responsibility to rise to the challenge. Our next big opportunity, remember the 19th, 20th, and 21st of November. Thank you.